This is Pursuing Justice. I'm your host, Harriet Hendel. We've been speaking to Professor Jessica Henry about wrongful conviction, but with a little twist. We will be continuing our discussion about wrongful convictions that occurred, but no crime was committed. And we've met Professor Henry last time. She's here again. She is a professor at Montclair State University in Montclair, New Jersey. She's an author, blogger, legal commentator, and social justice advocate. She got her JD from NYU School of Law and served as a public defender in New York City for almost a decade. She teaches classes about wrongful conviction, criminal law, hate crimes, and death penalty perspectives. And she's written a book that we've been speaking about called Smoke, But No Fire, Convicting the Innocent of Crimes That Never Happened. And it came out in 2020. So welcome back, Jessica, to the podcast. Good to have you again.
Thanks so much for having me.
So I encourage my listeners to go back and listen to part one, where we kind of laid the foundation for the topic we've been discussing, and we're going to continue to talk about it. So I'd like you to talk to us about women in prison for no crime convictions. They make up 9% of people locked up, but 70% of exonerees for crimes that never happened. That's shocking. Why is that?
Well, there's lots of different reasons. I think to be really specific, so women, you know, make up a small fraction of the people who are exonerated, right? So they're a small fraction, as you said, of the prison population in general, and a small fraction also of the people who are exonerated. And yet they have an outsized role in terms of what percentage they are of people who are exonerated for no crime cases. Over 70% of women in the National Registry of Exonerations were convicted in a no crime case. So that's kind of a shocking starting point. In general, no crime wrongful convictions are triggered either because a police person or a medical personnel or a prosecutor or somebody mislabels an event as a crime when it wasn't, or a false accusation is made. Or as we talked about, the police perhaps plant evidence. And when we think about that misclassification error, it often reflects gender biases, right? So women who are particularly vulnerable are women who don't fit the typical model. So they're not what fits within the paradigm of a good mother or a good person, or somehow they violate feminine norms. Those women are particularly vulnerable, particularly in cases that involve family members and young children.
Can you be a little more specific, you know, about certain crimes that they were accused of, but of course didn't do?
Yeah, so there's a case, and a wonderful book has been written about it by Valina Beatty. Lee Stubbs and Tammy Vance were two women who were wrongly accused of assaulting another woman. And the prosecution at trial relied on testimony, bad junk science from a discredited odontologist who, you know, claimed to see bite marks and whatever. But what really turned the case was, one, the odontologist's claim that bite marks would almost always be expected in cases involving people who were gay. And again, without evidence, another prosecution witness talked about homosexual crimes that are very sadistic. And this was in a very small town in Mississippi, which also, as a backdrop, had just banned gay marriage, right, in their constitution. And so the prosecution was leaning into biases about women who were potentially part of the LGBT community, even though there was no proof, by the way, that that in fact was true. And there was a conviction for aggravated assault. And they were sentenced to 44 years in prison, and they served 12 years in prison before they were finally exonerated. So women can become suspects. Either they're not emotional enough when the police arrive, or they're too emotional, or they don't look like or act like a good mother or wife or girlfriend or whatever. And these gender biases, of course, can be combined with other biases, intersectional biases based on race or ethnicity or socioeconomic status or sexual orientation. And that leaves women particularly vulnerable to no crime wrongful convictions.
Yeah. Now, there's a case that you talk about in the book of Beverly Monroe. Very interesting. Her daughter was on my podcast a couple of years ago. So tell us about Beverly Monroe.
Well, that's great that her daughter was on the podcast, because the only thing that's good about this story is her daughter at the end. I mean, I love.
Yes.
So Beverly Monroe is not necessarily your typical sort of vulnerable suspect, in the sense that she was a chemist and she was dating this man who claimed to have, I don't even know what he was doing. He claimed he was a count of some kind. I don't know. Anyway, he was found dead. And so Beverly Monroe was the last known person who had been in his presence. And she was 54 years old. She was a mom. She had a master's degree. I mean, you know, just not your typical person. But anyway, the officer who arrived at the scene decided it was a homicide. 100% just decided that this man must have been murdered and blamed it all on Beverly Monroe. Did not look for any other suspects. So didn't treat it as an open homicide, viewed it as a closed homicide, and refused to consider fairly compelling evidence that this, in fact, was a suicide. And in his relentless pursuit of Beverly Monroe, he eventually got her to make a few statements that were viewed as admissions. And even though she had a really strong alibi, she was convicted of murder and she was sentenced to 22 years in prison. And that might well have been sort of the end of the story. But her daughter, and this is why I love the fact that you had her on your show, because her daughter, Kate, was a brand new lawyer who took it upon herself to exonerate her mom. And she uncovered just unbelievable acts of misconduct. The investigator, who had so honed in on Beverly Monroe, hid evidence, engaged in an interrogation that, you know, is exactly what you are not supposed to ever do when you're interrogating a suspect. The prosecution sort of leaned in on the theory and also did not turn over evidence that was requested. There was information that one of the witnesses who testified was actually testifying to gain a benefit. No one knew about that. So there were all these outrageous things that Kate was able to uncover. And eventually, Ms. Monroe was cleared. But she served 11 years in prison for a suicide that had been wrongly labeled a murder.
Wow. Boy, without her daughter, where would she be? She'd still be there, right?
You know, and it's one of the things about wrongful convictions, not necessarily specific about no crime wrongful convictions, right, is that so often they're solved by coincidence. And it's so troubling that we have a legal system where coincidence is what's driving proof of innocence and correction of error, rather than a legal process that's really open to finding mistakes that were made below.
What's interesting about her daughter, the reason she was on is I had Jennifer Thompson, who has done a great, great deal with her case where she accused a man of assaulting and raping her and she made a mistake.
Yeah, Ronald Cotton.
The wrong man. Yeah. Well, that's right. And they wrote a book together. That's a fantastic story. So I had both of them on. So boy, kudos to Katie, right?
Kudos to her.
Wonderful. Misdemeanors. What would you like to say about that?
You know, I wanted to talk about misdemeanors because nobody talks about misdemeanors. And the nobody talks about misdemeanors is because we don't think of them as particularly consequential. And we don't know a lot about people who are wrongly convicted of misdemeanors. But what we do know is that many people are brought into the system. They're arrested. Remember, the standard for arrest is probable cause, more probable than not that a crime occurred and that the person committed it, not a particularly high standard. And once a person is brought into the system, they start accruing consequences, right? They aren't home to take care of their kids. So they run the risk of losing their children, even from a 3-day stint in jail. They have jobs that are at risk. They have other caregiving responsibilities. And so what happens is they get brought in for these low-level misdemeanors, and rather than having the capacity to fight them, they plead guilty. But the truth is, misdemeanor convictions have tremendous collateral consequences. It can mess you up when you're applying for a job or applying for certain kinds of housing, depending on the conviction that you have. They follow you forever. And so we don't think about them, and there are not that many known exonerations for misdemeanors, although there are a few. Like I talk about in my book, there was a man up in Alaska, Gregory Wasili, think that's his name. And he was walking home one evening and the police kind of rolled up on him and threw him to the ground and kind of roughed him up and then accused him of assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest. And he went to the local courthouse. He pled guilty that night and he went home. And that we never would have heard about this case ever. But there was happened to be, just happenstance, an anthropologist who was in this small town visiting, doing her research. And she saw the whole thing and she would not let it go. And she went to the precinct and made them get the recording from the store that happened to capture the whole thing on video. And sure enough, it proved that he had done absolutely nothing and that this officer had just kind of willy-nilly picked him up and roughed him up for no reason. That's an example of a misdemeanor that was based on a crime that never happened. And I suspect we see a lot of those. There's a lot of, for instance, drug cases, which can vary from misdemeanors to felonies. But down in Harris County, Texas, for instance, there were a whole bunch of people who were stopped by the police who did $2 field tests. The test came back positive for the presence of drugs. These folks were brought into the courthouse and they were offered a plea. And they were told like, hey, take this plea now because it ain't coming back. And so many, many people pled guilty to these drug offenses. And Harris County did something very unusual. Most of the time when a person pleads guilty in a drug case, that case is closed. And the sample of drugs is not sent to a lab for further confirmation because the person pled guilty. It's over. But Harris County, for whatever reason, continued to send those quote unquote drugs out to a lab. And it turns out that many, many people had been wrongly convicted based on false positives on these lousy, unreliable field tests. And to their credit, Harris County tried to find all of the people who were wrongly convicted based on these junk science, you know, field tests or unreliable field tests and exonerated whoever they could.
Well, that speaks well for them. That's rare for Texas, right? All right. Well, let's switch a little from actual cases to judges, lawyers, prosecutors, and police. You've kind of opened the door with the story you just told. How do they fit in to no crime, wrongful convictions? Let's start with judges. And if you want to talk about the Raymond Tucker case, that's up to you.
Sure. You know, one of the things I find fascinating is when you really look at people who think about wrongful convictions and write about wrongful convictions, judges are kind of a footnote. And I've always been struck by that because for every single wrongful conviction that occurred, there is a judge who presided over the case, who resolved pretrial hearings, who ruled on evidentiary motions, who accepted a plea or presented the case to a jury and who ultimately meted out a sentence. And then there are appellate courts who typically affirm those convictions. And so at every step of the way, courts were sort of present, but not necessarily doing what they could to reverse injustices when they occur. So in the case of Raymond Tucker, he was charged with breaking into a neighbor's house and stealing some valuables. And he went on a bench trial, which means he waived his right to a jury and allowed a judge to make the determination both about the facts of the case and the law. And the prosecution called a single witness who said, yeah, I think I saw a guy who looks like him jump over a fence. And one of the most compelling testimony. But Tucker was on parole. And at the end of the bench trial, the judge said, you know, this isn't the strongest case I've ever seen, but I'm finding you guilty and I'm sentencing you to 7 to 15 years in prison. It was a very severe sentence. And on direct appeal, the appellate judges were like, okay, fine. Looks fine to me. Looks fine to me, even though there really wasn't any evidence. The federal district court actually said, wait a minute, how did this guy get convicted? But then the prosecution appealed to a higher court and they said, oh no, this conviction was fine. But one of the judges on a 3-panel federal appeals court who looked at this case said, how was this man ever prosecuted, let alone convicted on such flimsy, non-existent evidence? But unfortunately for Mr. Tucker, that judge who spoke out was not in the majority of the judges who looked at his appeal. And he was sentenced and remained in prison to serve out his time.
And what did he serve?
I don't know what he ultimately served, but I know he was facing a maximum of 15 years in prison for that crime. And I have no idea whether there was an additional hit on the parole violation, right? So,
right.
You know, judges seem to emphasize finality over justice. And that's a problem. And our legal system itself is not particularly nimble in responding to new evidence that might help shine a light on somebody's innocence.
Yeah. Now, what about lawyers? How do they fit into this?
Well, they fit in a lot of different ways. But one thing that I did want to mention about judges, which will segue nicely, I think, to defense lawyers is, you know, many of us, I'm a former public defender, we went to law school in part because we don't have a science brain, right? We don't have that. I don't mean to sort of be so sweeping, but a lot of lawyers aren't scientists. And so one of the other things that judges don't do particularly well is determine forensic science that's reliable versus what is unreliable. They're not particularly good evidentiary gatekeepers. And so they allow into their courtroom junk science that really does not have a scientific basis, that isn't particularly valid, that isn't particularly replicable. And the same can be said for defense lawyers, right? Defense lawyers are often faced with what's seemingly very persuasive evidentiary findings by the prosecution that are really just junk. And if they had better training or better access to experts, they could kind of pierce that. You know, one of the things about defense lawyers is just how important they are. They're guaranteed in the Constitution. Our founding fathers understood, right, and wrote it into the Constitution, the Sixth Amendment, that people have the right to counsel. And later the Supreme Court clarified and said the right to counsel includes the right to the effective assistance of counsel. So that all sounds terrific. And then you start to look and you realize that the bar for what's effective is terribly low. There was a lawyer in Texas who slept through large parts of a capital case, and judge after judge after judge said, oh no, he didn't miss much. It's fine. Until eventually a higher level appellate court was like, we really can't do this. But, you know, so there's that goes on. You know, so defense lawyers can be incredibly powerful and are an incredible shield against the weight of the state and wrongful convictions when they can do their jobs properly. But many, particularly public defenders in urban centers, are overwhelmed by caseloads that are just unreasonable. We do not invest in indigent defense in the way that we should. There are stories from various parts of the country where a defense lawyer will have 1,000 misdemeanors. Well, that averages out to be about an hour per case. You can't do justice in an hour per case. And so there's that. There's often a limited access, as I said, to experts that could help them parse through seemingly strong forensic evidence. And so we see, and sometimes depending on the jurisdiction, there's just lawyers that are given cases that probably shouldn't be practicing law. And so there's a whole host of ways in which defense lawyers could be really effective, but sometimes aren't.
And now we move to prosecutors, and the title of that chapter is Winning at All Costs. Expand on that.
Yeah, it's a really interesting thing, right? Because prosecutors are supposed to be ministers of justice. That's their lofty title. That's what the Supreme Court says about them, ministers of justice. And for anyone who's ever watched a Law and Order episode, you know, it starts out with the people of the state of New York or wherever it is versus John Smith. And the people refers to me and you. It refers to people who are harmed by crimes. It also refers to people who are accused of crimes and their families. And so that gets lost somehow, this mission of doing justice for the people, all the people, even if justice in particular cases means not getting a conviction. And instead, how justice comes to be defined in prosecutor offices is getting convictions, right? Winning at all costs. Getting convictions is defined as winning. And what that means is prosecutors will double down on cases with really bad evidence. They'll shore up their weak cases by bringing in jailhouse informants. They'll offer plea bargains when they should really just dismiss cases outright that they can't prove. And so prosecutors play fast and loose with rules of evidence. They don't turn over evidence that they are required to, and they harm thousands of people in the process.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking ahead 5, maybe 10 years, what changes in our legal system, justice system, do you hope to see?
Well, if we're talking specifically about innocence and about trying to help reduce the number of innocent people who are wrongly convicted, I think there is a lot that we can do. You know, depending on what state you're in, some states have enacted really strong reforms around eyewitness identification or confession evidence. Many states have not, but some states have. New Jersey, where I'm from, for instance, has a really robust eyewitness identification process that reflects sort of the best standards based on, you know, what we know about eyewitness identification. So they sequential lineups versus making people look, identify people all at the same time. There's a whole bunch of things that have happened. Or in the context of interrogations, it's starting a recording of an interrogation from the very moment a person is interrogated.
Absolutely.
All the way through. That's another example. But I think we need to do a much better job. And by the way, that's only a small number of cases, right? I think we need to do a much better job of understanding forensic science and its limitations and empowering judges, whether it is by really helping judges understand the evidence better or by having neutral forensic scientists appointed to particular courthouses to advise judges. There are things that we could do better and differently that might reduce the number of wrongful convictions that are based on bad science. And that's just a few things off the top of my head. I think we also need to hold prosecutors accountable. People don't appreciate that. You know, it's interesting. If I ask people today, what is qualified immunity? A lot of people know that police have qualified immunity because they've heard about it. They're not necessarily sure what it means, but they know about it. But what people don't know is that prosecutors have absolute immunity from prosecution. You cannot sue a prosecutor for their wrongdoing as a prosecutor, no matter how egregious whatever it is that they did. We need to change that because right now prosecutors get to act with impunity and suffer no consequences. And so that, I think, is a reform that we could do that would be meaningful and have an impact.
I think the only case of a prosecutor being brought to justice was in the Michael Morton case in Texas.
Yeah, and also Mike Nifong in the Duke lacrosse cases, right? I mean, he was, I think, disbarred ultimately. Yeah, and the Michael Morton case, that judge certainly didn't suffer significantly.
No. But he went on record, at least, saying you hid evidence and I spent 25 years in jail as a result.
Yeah.
So at least he got some publicity. Well, we are unfortunately out of time, but this was wonderful to have you on today, Professor Henry. I want to mention that you are donating all proceeds of your book to either the Innocence Project based in New York City or the one here in Princeton, Centurion Ministries, which was the first innocence organization in the world. My thanks to you for spending time with us on Pursuing Justice, and also to the Innocence Project of Florida for sponsoring my podcast, and to Jordan Moore at the Podcabin, my producer. Our next podcast, we will be talking to Mark Godsey, who is founder of the Ohio Innocence Project and the author of Blind Injustice. Please join us then, and thanks for spending part of your day with us. See you next time on Pursuing Justice.